WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America's foremost cabaret singer, Bobby Short, has a new CD celebrating his 30th anniversary at the elegant New York night spot, the Café Carlyle. On today's archive edition, we have an interview we recorded back in 1985 after the publication of his memoir. Short's vast repertoire covers the history of American popular song, from early Kern in Berlin to Sondheim. His performances and records have kept alive Porter and Gershwin favorites and have revived many of their forgotten gems. Let's start with a song from one of Bobby Short's early albums, recorded in the late 1950s. The song is Fun to be Fooled, with music by Harold Arlen and a lyric by Ira Gershwin and Yip Harburg.
Spring is here. I'm a fool if I fall again, and yet I'm intrigued by love's call again. You say you love me, I know from the past. You mean to love me, but these things don't last. Fools rush in to begin new love affairs. But tonight, tonight, my dear, who cares? Fun to be fooled, fun to pretend, fun to believe love is unending. Thought I was done, still it is fun to be fooled again. Nice when you tell all that you feel. Nice to be told this is the real thing. Fun to be kissed, fun to exist, to be fooled again. It's that old devil moon having his fling once more, selling me spring once more. I'm afraid love is king once more. Fun to be fooled, fun to pretend. This little dream won't end. Once more, fun to be fooled, fun to pretend this little dream won't end.
Bobby Short singing and accompanying himself at the piano. Short represents sophistication, but he's not a native of the high society that embraced him. He grew up in Danville, Illinois, where his mother was active in the church and made a living as a domestic. Short played roadhouses and the vaudeville circuit before reaching puberty. Bobby Short told me that when he was a child, jazz was frowned on by the church, but he listened anyway.
If your mother was kind of strict about what kind of music you went to hear, how did you end up playing in roadhouses and saloons when you were nine?
Well, you have to remember that back in those days, there was a deep, deep depression spread over America, and money was awfully hard to come by. And the fact that I could earn money made a lot of things different.
What kind of material were you playing when you were a child?
Jazz. Oh, pure jazz. We played all the popular songs in the saloons. People danced. And then when I was 12, I left Danville and I became involved in honest-to-goodness vaudeville.
And what were you doing there?
I was playing the piano and singing then, but I was in a white tail suit, you see, on the stage, and I performed with great dignity. And I was a child performer.
Did you have to learn to tap dance and things like that?
Oh, no. I think every other colored kid in America, I say colored because that was the word they used in those days, on the stage tap danced. I could never learn the tap dance very well. And I played the piano and sang. I was given lessons constantly. I could not learn to dance. And I played and sang, though, and I had my white tail suit. I performed on vaudeville stages around the Midwest and part of the East.
Were you singing songs with sophisticated and world-weary lyrics when you were 12?
Well, it was difficult in those days to find songs that were exactly suitable for a 12-year-old. There were a couple of kids around in those days performing, and so whenever big star kids, I mean, like Judy Garland and Bobby Breen and Deanna Durbin and Harold Nicholas, and whenever they sang a song, I think, well, this is appropriate for me to sing. But it was not easy to find songs for a kid to sing. Of course, I preferred to sing about smoking and drinking and never thinking of tomorrow.
What did it mean to you, though?
Oh, it just meant sophistication, I suppose, and grown up, which, of course, I was not. But my mind was very receptive to sophisticated music. And so, of course, it didn't matter to me about the lyrics. I just thought they were something that went along with the music.
Had you taken piano lessons?
Not really. I'm self-taught. Mainly. And at one point during my very early years at the piano, my mother thought that I should take lessons. Because in those days, every household had a piano, and always somebody in the household played the piano. And my mother played the piano tiny bit. All the renders, all that's my mother's family, were musical to some degree.
Well, you have extraordinary enunciation. Do you credit any of that to your vocal coach?
My vocal coach, and I think my good ear, and really whiz-bang high school education in Danville, Illinois.
Are there any, like, secrets to enunciating without doing anything that really exaggerates the language too much?
I think there are tricks, and those tricks are some of the things that I learned from my old music teacher in Illinois at Danville High School. I think there are ways to go about pronouncing certain sounds, certain vowel sounds, that make the sounds less offensive, because sometimes an ow sound can sound terrible. You don't want to you learn to say now instead of now. And you learn to grab onto those consonants as quickly as you possibly can. And there are ways.
You were telling us a couple of minutes ago that you took voice lessons, but you're self-taught at the piano. Do you know how to read music? Did you teach yourself
how
to
really
do that?
Not really very well at all. And I have such respect now for the music that I play that I don't rely upon myself at all to take a song and learn it cold. If I'm really in difficulty, I'll call in a pianist to teach me the song.
And they'll sit down and...
Sit down and show me the proper chords, and I have this indestructible memory which has helped me all these years.
I figure you must, because you know hundreds and hundreds of songs.
Yes.
Do you ever blank out on the words?
I have a few times, but most of the time, I have a computer inside somewhere. If I just press the right combination of numbers, it all comes rolling right out again after years and years and years of neglect.
When did you start actually developing the repertoire that you're famous for now of popular song standards, Rodgers and Hart, Cole Porter, the Gershwins, Irving Berlin?
I began that as soon as I knew about it. I heard a funny story about a young lady from Mississippi who had moved to New York, and somebody said, when did you first go to New York? She said, as soon as I heard about it. And as soon as I heard about Rodgers and Hart, I didn't know a thing about Rodgers and Hart in Danville, Illinois. Cole Porter was a name we all knew about, but we didn't know about Rodgers and Hart. We didn't know about Arthur Schwartz and Howard Dietz. We knew about George Gershwin, of course, and Rhapsody in Blue and Porgy and Bess. But the people who were the mainstays on the Broadway musical stage were unknown to us in a small town like Danville. But as soon as I left Danville, I learned about those things, and it became an all-consuming interest with me, and I set about learning all I could possibly learn.
Could you tell what attracted you to those songs? Why you knew that was it and not Boogie Woogie and not the blues?
I don't know. I felt that I was better equipped to... I've always had a great fondness for the language. And then I had 4 years of English in high school, which should tell you something. And I've always been attracted to words and the putting together of phrases and sentences. And I used to write poetry when I was a child. And I felt that to sing these songs was not going to wear me out and bore me. And so I learned them. It wasn't easy because my agents at the time would have had a much easier time promoting a black boy who played Boogie Woogie and sang than a young black boy who was singing the latest hits from some obscure Cole Porter show on Broadway. But I'd learned the rudiments of performing when I was a child. And so I was always entertaining the people, and it didn't much matter with what I was entertaining them, so long as I entertained them.
You have been at the Cafe Carlyle since 1968.
Yes.
Can you tell us the story of how you first became the pianist and singer there?
Oh, it's not a big story. It's just that I was called in when the new owner, Peter Sharp, owned the hotel. He called me in one day to take the place of his vacationing pianist who'd been there for a long time. And I was a great success in the room. And so, of course, they asked me if I'd come back and play an engagement there. And, of course, I wanted to because I'd always wanted to work at the Cafe Carlyle. And with that, I believe they offered their steady pianist half the year and me the other half of the year. And he did not like that arrangement at all. And so they gave the whole year to me, which I quickly altered to suit my own capacities.
We're featuring a 1985 interview with Bobby Short, who is now celebrating his 30th anniversary at the Cafe Carlyle in New York. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to our interview with Bobby Short, let's hear him do a song from one of the composers he's most associated with, Cole Porter. This is Short's 1957 recording of Dream Dancing.
When day is gone and night comes on, until the dawn, what do I do? I touch your hand and wander through slumberland, dream dancing with you. We glide between a sky serene and fields of green, sparkling with dew. It's joy sublime whenever I spend my time dream dancing with you. Dream dancing, oh, what a lucky windfall, touching you, clutching you, so say you love me, dear, and let me make my career dream dancing to paradise prancing, dream dancing with you, dream dancing. Oh, what a lucky windfall, touching you, clutching you, all the night through. So say you love me, dear, and let me make my career dream dancing to paradise prancing.
What do you see your role as being in American popular music?
Oh, I don't know. I am so shy about trying to put a label on myself. I just think that I play and sing what I like, and I don't attach any long-term importance to it. It's given me pleasure. It's earned me a comfortable living, and it's entertained a lot of people, I suppose, over the years. But I don't look upon myself as some kind of prophet or paragon of invention or whatever, you know. I'm kind of a keeper of the flame, I suppose.
Well, one of the things you've done for me as a listener is introduce me to songs that I fear I wouldn't otherwise have found out about, and then, you know, kept songs alive that I've really enjoyed, too. How do you find the songs that are the lesser-known gems that you perform?
Well, I have a rather good ear for things like that. And then, of course, if it gets around that you're into songs like that, people who have access to them are all too willing to bring them to you. Many of the songs that I learned in the 1940s were brought to me by people who had heard them in shows or who loved them and hadn't heard them since they'd seen the show. I was lucky enough to meet people who had written some of those songs, and of course they brought their songs to me. People like Burton Lane and Cole Porter.
What did Cole Porter bring to you?
Oh, goodness, I can't even think. But he certainly gave me lots of extra lyrics to things.
Did you ever perform when Cole Porter was in the room?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Many times.
Did he have a way that he liked his songs interpreted?
Well, I never found him fidgety about his songs being interpreted by performers. I never found him demanding or too critical. Many composers are. But this was a very level-headed, I believe, very democratic man, Cole Porter. And I think that he was always aware of the fact that he came from Piru, Indiana. I think more and more that he was aware of that. And from a little society, a very socially ambitious mother. But he was not a part automatically of the society that he sought or that took him up. And I think he remembered all of those humble beginnings. I don't mean humble in terms of poverty, because he was not poor ever. But let's face it, coming from the Midwest and going off to crash into Eastern society back in those days just wasn't being done very often.
It's funny because his songs really define that kind of society, and he wasn't even from it.
And so that is another thing that I've thought about a lot. I think that not being part of it gave him a chance to be objective about it more than he could have been had he been part of the society.
Isn't that true of you in a way, too? Because you were an outsider to New York.
Absolutely.
High society.
Absolutely.
And now you've become a symbol of it.
Well, not really. Not ever really a part of it. But I think that I share that with Cole Porter a great deal.
Have your friends or fellow performers ever urged you to get with it and sing the now song, sing the songs of today?
Well, I went through a very, very bleak period in the 1960s when Beatlesitis took over the universe. And it was very tough going for a while. And it was amazing how many people came to me and said, look, if you want me to finance you, I'll finance you. You can buy yourself an act. That was the idea. Then you bought an act. You got a choreographer and you got an act. Learned some new songs and went out to Las Vegas, I suppose, and earned zillions of dollars a week. I was asked to record this and record that and to change my style and to change other things about myself, the way I dressed, the way I looked, the way I presented myself. And it was very interesting, but I held on and stuck to my guns and managed to survive.
Was it suggested that you start wearing jumpsuits? And
well, costumes, you know, just something smart from Saint Laurent. Something in velvet or, you know, a coverall in silk or whatever, just something far out.
But you don't expect to ever change either your repertoire or your...
I don't think so.
...style of singing.
I don't think so. There's danger in that at this point. I think that what it is that I've become is a fairly solidly founded thing, and it's certainly regarded by people who support me as something solid. And to move out of that into something else would be a shock, not only to my supporters and my fans, but also to to my own sense of integrity.
Bobby Short, recruited in 1985. His new CD is called Bobby Short and His Orchestra, celebrating 30 years at the Cafe Carlyle.